Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ralph Casa from the Pacific Forum, CSIS. I can't tell you how delighted I am to be here in Washington, D.C., rather than in Honolulu this morning. We've been having a cold spell there. The temperature this morning was actually down in the low 20s, but fortunately that was centigrade. So, but I think it's delighted to see so many people here. I have been privileged to be a part of this project that Bonnie has been running for the last 2 years, and this is the second volume. I hope many of you have seen the first volume as well on cross-strait CBMs. The time, I believe, has never been better to move forward on cross-strait CBMs. There is a growing confidence on both sides, a growing willingness to talk. Still a lot of suspicions and a lot of apprehensions. One of the things this project has been trying to do over the past couple of years is better identify the roadblocks to cooperation, to sort of not just act as a facilitator, but also to try to solve some of the problems and provide new ideas. I would say there was a sea change in attitude difference between 2008 and 2009. But I don't think we're at a point where anyone should be overconfident. In my view, there's still a lot of concerns, a lot of suspicions, a lot of additional work that needs to be done. And the opportunity, I think, for miscalculation, for accidents that could get out of control are still very high. So in my view, the time has never been better. The two sides have never been more willing, and this is really the time to move forward. I commend Bonnie for her activities in two regards. She's also brought this renegade outfit on this small island called Pacific Forum here to our parent on the mainland, CSIS, just to sort of provide an example for how the mainland and Taiwan can also cooperate. So at this point, let me turn things over to Bonnie, please.
Great analogy, Ralph. Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming. The delegation that CSIS took to Taiwan and to the mainland to talk about CBMs last year went in late August, early September. And, of course, there have been many things that have transpired since then. What I've really tried to do in this report is lay out the current situation in cross-strait relations and talk about the prospects for CBMs and examine the perspectives on both sides of the strait to look at how both sides see the possible preconditions for CBMs, what kind of CBM agenda they might seek to pursue, and also what objectives they would seek to achieve respectively in implementing CBMs. And not surprisingly, there is some overlap between the two sides of the strait, but there's also significant differences. What we've seen, of course, since Ma Ying-jeou has come to power as president of Taiwan about 20 months ago, is really a significant improvement in the cross-strait relationship. Direct flights have commenced, and 12 agreements have been signed on functional matters. There's a diplomatic truce that's essentially in place, albeit informal and only tacitly accepted by China. And Beijing removed its opposition to Taiwan becoming an observer at the WHA meeting in 2009. And that was a good, I would say, small but good first step toward welcoming Taiwan as a participant in the international community. Now, clearly, the dispute over sovereignty remains, but it is to some extent in the background, at least for now. Both sides have agreed to shelve their differences on political matters and to seek to cooperate where common ground exists. The basis for this cooperation is, of course, the 1992 consensus, which enables both sides to recognize the existence of one China, but call that one China or define it the way that they respectively define it. Now, the leaders on both sides of the strait, Ma Ying-jeou on Taiwan and Hu Jintao on the mainland, have set out important long-term goals. They have both stated that they support the eventual signing of a peace accord, an agreement on ending hostilities across the strait, and the establishment of a military confidence-building mechanism. Now, none of these topics are yet on the formal negotiating agenda between the two sides, and both sides really do judge it as premature to engage in official discussions on these topics yet. There's no clear roadmap on how to even proceed toward these long-term goals. And indeed, I would say there's really no agreement on the definitions or even the sequencing of these eventual objectives, either within Taiwan and within the mainland or as well as between them. But it does seem logical, at least to me, that confidence-building measures would come first. Greater trust and confidence is needed, I think, as a precursor to negotiating more complex agreements. Now, CBMs can be broadly defined as formal and informal measures that address, prevent, or resolve uncertainties between parties. Now, usually, in the Western experience, I would say the majority of the time, CBMs have been implemented between sovereign states. But there are ample examples where CBMs have been implemented between non-sovereign parties. And one example that I would cite would be the PLO's CBMs with Israel. And when I led the delegation in 2008, both to Taiwan and the mainland, we talked about CBMs not just in the military sphere, but also in non-traditional areas, CBMs, for example, in health and environmental areas. And since then, probably unrelated to our visit, there has been some headway, I would say, in cooperation between the two sides of the strait on non-traditional security areas. And one that I would cite that I think was rather significant was a search and rescue exercise that was held between the two sides of the strait in October 2008, the picture of which is on the cover of my report, and the that simulated a fire on one of the three mini-links, the Xiaosantong boats that ferries passengers back and forth from Xiamen to Jinmen. No military units involved, but nevertheless, I think, a good example of cooperation in maritime safety. So this past August and early September, when we went back to Taiwan and the mainland, we really focused exclusively on military CBMs. In the Western experience, military CBMs have been steps that increase the predictability of military actions and therefore reduce the risks of miscalculation or accidents. Now, some initial unilateral steps have been taken by both sides, and so I would argue that the process of establishing cross-strait military CBMs is really already underway. There have not been negotiated agreements, but there are some important moves that both sides have taken, and these actually go back many years, and I discuss some of these in my report. For example, Taiwan publicly announces its military exercise annually, declares that it will not fire the first shot, and more recently, last year, employed a disaster relief scenario for the 2009 Hanguang exercise rather than focusing on in a scenario of attack from the mainland. The PRC, for its part, has also made unilateral gestures. For example, last year, an exercise was moved out of the Nanjing military region a bit farther from Taiwan's shores. So why are military CBMs desirable? First, as I mentioned, they can reduce the risk of an unintended accident. Fighters from both sides of the strait do seek to avoid each other, as do ships, but I would argue that the danger of collision still exists, and there are steps that both sides can take to ensure that that does not occur. It's also important to create channels of communication. so that if an accident occurs or some kind of a crisis, that escalation can be controlled. There can be means by which the two sides can quickly get in touch with each other to clarify the situation. I would also say that it's important to nurture some relationship between the two militaries. After all, we've seen businessmen and athletes, scholars from both sides of the strait getting to know each other after having been separated for so many years. And the two militaries are completely estranged, have had no contact for 60 years. And I would say from my conversations with militaries on both sides of the strait that they have very limited understanding of each other. So I think that would be useful. And then finally, looking out longer term, I think military CBMs can create a basis for Taiwan to participate in multilateral military exercise activities, which, of course, it is barred from doing at the moment. But if once there are perhaps cross-strait CBMs, perhaps the mainland would welcome Taiwan's participation in humanitarian assistance, disaster relief-type exercises, just as Taiwan hopes after the signing of the cross-strait economic agreement to have free trade-type agreements with other countries. So what are the obstacles? And here is where I want to talk a little bit about the perspectives on both sides of the strait and where there really are some differences. The first question that I'd like to address is the time right for CBMs right now? Are the two sides ready to negotiate? And clearly, from Taiwan's perspective, the answer is no. Taiwan officials and scholars argue that there is a lack of a domestic consensus on Taiwan, that engaging in negotiations on military CBMs prematurely could even put in jeopardy the progress that has been made so far in improving relations across the strait. So they argue this is something that should not be entered into until the citizens in Taiwan are well prepared. They have learned, I think, some lessons from the cross-strait economic framework agreement that they are trying to negotiate that has engendered some concern, opposition internally. And I think people in Taiwan, particularly the ruling government, also fears that entering into these discussions prematurely would provide the opposition, the DPP, with more ammunition to further accuse Ma of compromising sovereignty and betraying the country. Taiwan also argues that China should not pressure Taiwan to engage in these talks before it is ready. And they do perceive that there is growing pressure from the mainland to talk about politically sensitive issues and to talk about military CBMs. And the sense in Taiwan is that this is an outgrowth of Beijing's sense of its own rising power and its growing confidence. There's also a perception in Taiwan that Beijing believes that it's already responded positively to Taiwan's demand for dignity and greater international space, and that therefore now it is time for Taiwan to take more steps to address Beijing's concerns. And so these are some of the concerns that Taiwan has, arguing that the time, again, is not right. China, however, believes that efforts should be made to take full advantage of what they refer to as the period of strategic opportunity period, not just in the global international situation, but also in cross-strait relations. And that talks should start informally between scholars who are authorized by their governments to probe both sides to see what the possibilities are to agree on a CBM agenda. And one of the reasons why there's growing impatience on the mainland is because there is concern about Ma Ying-jeou's persistent low ratings in public opinion polls and the possibility that the DPP can return to power. So there is some growing urgency to get something accomplished in the near term, to make more progress, and to convince the people on Taiwan that there are more benefits from the cross-strait relationship, not just economically, but also in other spheres. There's also, I would say, a widely held belief that if discussion on political and military issues is postponed too long, that this could result in obstacles to further cooperation, even in the economic sphere. The second question that we discussed on both sides of the strait was whether there should be preconditions for CBM negotiations. And here, I think we found profound differences between the two sides. Taiwan argues, particularly President Ma Ying-jeou argues, that the missiles that China has deployed opposite Taiwan should be removed before the signing of a peace accord. And he has generally stated that CBMs would be part of a peace accord, not something that would occur before, although there are some officials who hold different views, and I don't think that is necessarily set in stone. There are also arguments on Taiwan that China should renounce its intention to use force and modify the anti-secession law that was passed by the National People's Congress in 2005. That has not been stated as a formal position, but that is a widely held view. Now, of course, from the Chinese side, there is an official view that is enunciated by officials as well as scholars that any adjustments in military deployments should be reciprocal and should be a subject for bilateral discussion, not a precondition. The Chinese argue that without political assurances from Taiwan that it will forego de jure independence, that they cannot take steps to reduce China's military buildup. And some Chinese assert that a unilateral drawdown of missiles would have the appearance of acting under pressure from Taiwan. And they say that making unwarranted concessions could engender domestic criticism of the leadership on the mainland. Some in China also call for Taiwan to accept Beijing's One China principle as a precondition for engaging in talks on CBMs. Again, not a formal official position, but it is widely discussed both in the media and in private conversations. I think this is a non-starter, certainly from what we have heard on Taiwan. For Taiwan, the 1992 consensus would have to be sufficient for engaging in discussions on CBMs. There is not likely to be any progress toward acceptance of the One China principle. Now, there's also a discussion about, it's a little bit different than preconditions, but creating conditions. How should the appropriate conditions be created so that both sides can be more amenable to engaging in these negotiations? And Taiwan thinks that there's more that the mainland can do in addition to pulling back or destroying its missiles to create conditions for beginning informal discussions of CBMs. For example, Taiwan military officers suggest that the mainland refrain from obstructing military personnel from engaging in international military security fora, in dialogues, and conferences organized by non-governmental organizations. And they also hope that the mainland will follow Taiwan's practice of announcing its exercises in advance, the size, the scopes, the date, and the location. Again, Taiwan also believes that there should be no linkage between military CBMs and Taiwan's arms purchases from the United States. And there certainly are people on the mainland who would like to link the two together. And we'd like to see that arms sales from the U.S. Slow and eventually come to an end. This is something of great concern to Taiwan. Taiwan believes if it enters into negotiations that even if the mainland does not set this out as a precondition, that it will use the fact that these discussions are taking place, that there's improvement in ties and military relations between the two sides of the strait, to argue that these arms sales to Taiwan are no longer necessary. So this is a concern on the Taiwan side. Finally, on the Chinese side, there is concern that CBMs not be used to legitimize the existence of Taiwan as a separate sovereign state. And again, as I said at the outset, CBMs are not necessarily limited to sovereign states, but China believes that Taiwan could use a CBM process between the two sides to strengthen its de facto independence. Finally, the last question that I want to talk about is what should be the primary objectives of CBMs? And here again, there's some overlap, but there's also, I think, important differences. Taiwan, from a broad perspective, views military CBMs as aimed at securing a stable status quo between the two sides of the strait. Taiwan seeks to preserve the status quo. The vast majority of people on Taiwan prefer that the status quo be preserved. And CBMs can be a means of further stabilizing that status quo. Now, many people on the mainland talk about CBMs as part of China's agenda to promote reunification. But even more importantly, they point out that CBMs should not be aimed at perpetuating the status quo indefinitely. And there's one individual who's a military officer who's warned against warned against the peaceful separation of the two sides of the strait. And he's from the Academy of Military Sciences. He sees, and I think some others in the Chinese military see, the possibility that CBMs could be used by Taiwan to promote the separation of the two sides. Looking at the issue more tactically, one of Taiwan's principal objectives in negotiating CBMs is to reduce the risk of accident that could escalate to unintended conflict, as I talked about earlier. And this concern is reflected in the 2009 National Defense Report, which states that the probability of military friction is rather high. Should there be a lack of mutual trust on both sides, any mishaps or accidents will be misinterpreted as deliberate provocation and further result in full-scale military conflict. That's a quote from the most recent Taiwan National Defense White Paper. The Chinese, I think, would say that preventing accidental conflict is a secondary order objective, and the primary goal is to build mutual trust and to promote camaraderie and understanding between the two militaries. Military experts in China talk about discussing shared military culture, Sun Tzu's art of war, for example, discussing the experiences that the two militaries shared fighting against the Japanese in the 1930s and 40s, and how to defend common claims in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea. These are the kinds of topics that we heard from the Chinese that they would be interested in discussing as part of a CBM process. The implications, of course, for the United States, for the rest of the region, I think are very important to examine. And in the report, I have a short discussion of what the U.S. role should be in cross-strait CBMs, which I see as rather limited, encouraging, but not pressing an agenda, and certainly not pushing both sides to do anything that they are not ready to do, especially Taiwan. There is also a suggestion, a section on policy recommendations for all three sides at the end of the report. But rather talk about that, which you can read by yourselves. I thought that we would ask Mike Green,
to give his perspective on this issue and the implications of the evolving cross-strait relationship and the potential for engaging in military CBMs discussions between the two sides.
Well, thank you. And I want to congratulate Bonnie and Ralph on this report. It's one more example of what Bonnie does so well, which is really testing propositions on both sides of the strait. Of course, it's also interesting because it's an analytical piece, but in a way, it is part of this whole process. It contributes to this process of trying to build confidence and explore options towards the future. I was on the NSC staff for 5 years, worked on this issue, among others. Of course, I'm not an official now. I only play one on TV. But I will try to give a perspective on what I imagine a U.S. government view would be on cross-straits confidence-building measures in the years to come. As Bonnie pointed out, there's a steady, measured, fairly slow pace to this process, but it's conceivable in the coming years that there could be very quick movement on some of the recommendations that are in this report. So it's worth considering what the U.S. perspective might be. I thought I'd talk about the broad parameters of how the U.S. would approach this issue and then react to some of the specific recommendations for CBMs in the report, again, as a U.S. government official might view them in future, and then explore a bit more what roles the U.S. could play beyond the recommendations in the report on the U.S. It's worth stating at the beginning, and Bonnie and Ralph have this in the report, that there's consistent and bipartisan and public support for cross-straits confidence-building measures. The report quotes Kurt Campbell from the Clinton administration, encouraging and supporting these efforts and noting their importance. Jim Kelly, Assistant Secretary under George Bush, and most recently Jim Steinberg, all with fairly similar approaches, arguing that that the U.S. would be supportive of cross-straits confidence-building measures. And it makes sense from the perspective of U.S. interests. These kinds of CBMs are consistent with the U.S. Interest in a peaceful resolution of issues across the straits, consistent with the U.S. interest in finding a variety of ways to have greater transparency in PLA, modernization and operations, and also a genuine U.S. concern about avoiding accidental conflict that could undermine security and stability in the region. As Bonnie points out in the report, the rules of engagement for both the ROC, Air Force, and Navy and their PLA counterparts have thus far been careful to prevent the kind of close interaction that would lead to accidental conflict, but it's a dynamic situation with a changing order of battle and new technologies. So the U.S. would clearly have an interest in steps taken by both sides to avoid any possible accidents. It was interesting to me that the delegation found in the PRC almost no interest in an active U.S. role in cross-straits CBMs, but in Taiwan, considerable interest in the U.S. playing some role to oversee, to guarantee, to help add leverage. The report notes at the end, very briefly, that the U.S. role would be constrained. The U.S. would not broker or participate in directly negotiations. And the report has three basic recommendations for the U.S., which make a lot of sense. First, encourage cross-strait CBMs. Second, maintain a consistent U.S. message on Taiwan policy. And third, I think related to that, no unilateral changes in the U.S. approach on this issue or on cross-straits. In other words, be a steadying hand behind the scenes. I think it's possible to go beyond that, and especially now that I'm not in government, and speculate a bit more about what role the U.S. might play. Before doing that, it's worth reminding everyone the parameters within which I think any U.S. government now or in the future would approach this. The first, which I think probably 70% of this room has memorized, but I'll restate it anyway, would be the six assurances, which have a direct bearing on this. First, that the U.S. would not set a date for ending arms sales to the ROC. Second, the U.S. would not hold prior consultations with Beijing on arms sales to the ROC. Third, and in this case, probably most important, the U.S. would not play a mediating role between the PRC and the ROC. Fourth, the U.S. will not revise the Taiwan Relations Act. Fifth, the U.S. will not alter its position on the question of Taiwan. And sixth, the U.S. will not pressure Taiwan to enter into negotiations with the PRC. Those six assurances, I think, probably informed the delegation's recommendations on how the U.S. should approach CBMs. If we imagine that cross-strait CBMs could pick up some more momentum in the future, I think there are some other considerations that at least in an unstated way would guide U.S. thinking about cross-straits confidence building. First, I think the U.S. would have an interest in ensuring that Taiwan did not negotiate an imbalance in forces or make permanent the growing delta, the growing gap in capabilities, or in any way take steps through CBMs that would undermine Taiwan's capabilities or readiness to dissuade or deter the PRC side from using force. No one's proposing that, but I think that would be, as CBMs move forward, something the U.S. officials would watch. In addition, I think the U.S. would want to watch carefully to ensure that any CBMs did not have any detrimental impact on other U.S. security equities in the region beyond Taiwan. Specifically, I'm thinking of Articles 5 and 6 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, the defense of Japan and the stability of the Far East, and the longstanding U.S. interest in ensuring freedom of navigation. So these are things that would be watched. And so overall, I think that in terms of process, there would be a keen U.S. interest in close consultation and transparency between Taipei and Washington as these CBMs move forward, if they do. And Bonnie makes that point very well in the report. In terms of the specific recommendations, again, from one U.S. perspective, the report talks about near-term steps or near-term CBM proposals that include white papers, more information on military exercises, perhaps expanding Beijing's pledge on WMD with respect to the cross-strait situation, perhaps modest cuts in forces or realignment ideas. I think all of these would be generally in U.S. interests and would be supported. In some ways, I would think because of the U.S. interest in avoiding accidents, there may be a perspective in Washington that some of these CBMs aimed at avoiding accidents don't necessarily have to wait for larger political developments. But I don't think any U.S. administration would press Taiwan to pursue CBMs before there's a domestic consensus to do so. But that said, I do think that some of these things designed at preventing accidents have a merit above and beyond the politics. One of the near-term CBM proposals that caught my eye that I think raised a yellow card, if not a red card, if I may, was the proposal to modify exercises. The report suggests that perhaps as a near-term CBM, the ROC could focus more on exercises related to humanitarian relief operations, search and rescue operations other than war. That jumped out at me as potentially problematic because it seems to me in order to enhance the ROC's ability to dissuade and deter the use of force, a lot of what Taiwan has to do is not in the hardware category or the arms procurement category. It's in what you might call the software category. In other words, correcting problems in interoperability, sustainability, readiness, things that have to be exercised so that the different branches of the ROC military are making up for gaps that have been there for a long time. And I would be more cautious about putting in place an exercise regime in Taiwan that would make it more difficult for Taiwan to address some of these shortcomings that are necessary to have effective deterrence and dissuasion. So I'll be interested in Bonnie's reaction to that. But that jumped out at me. The report also talks about what it calls more advanced measures, things that are a bit more ambitious, including hotlines. I think that's an excellent proposal. We should be realistic. The U.S. has found that hotlines with the PRC are of limited utility. Often in a crisis, the PRC side doesn't want to pick up the phone. So it's a nice tool to have, but it's not the silver bullet sometimes people would expect. It's a bit more symbolic in some ways. Military exchanges, of course, an excellent proposal. I think from a U.S. perspective, there would be some interest in ensuring protection of sensitive information to the extent that senior military officers are increasing exchanges across the straits. The U.S. would want to make sure that it has some understanding of what issues are being discussed and that sensitive operational discussions or intel sharing or other things are not on the table. Including the military in the SEF-ARETS talks is a good idea. Maritime cooperation is good. As this picture shows, I think maritime cooperation, and this is true for Japan's experience and others in Asia, is easier if you start with the Coast Guard. The Navy, in some ways, is the last service at sea if you want to start working your way towards confidence building on these issues. Nothing against the Navy, but the Coast Guard is seen as at least half civilian and a bit easier politically to get these things started. Risk reduction agreements are good also, as long as they don't, as I say, impinge on rules of engagement or other ways or otherwise get in the way of readiness. One of the suggestions that the delegation heard strongly in Taipei was that a missile pullback would be an important move by the PRC, and I think that's absolutely right. I would caution on that one that we need to distinguish between symbolism and substance, between gestures and real threat reduction. I was in the NSC when President Jiang Zemin proposed a vague idea for a missile pullback to President Bush in 2002. Randy Shriver and others and I and others pursued this subsequently a few years later to try to see if there was some more there. And my impression was that this was a Ministry of Foreign Affairs idea that was put in President Jiang's briefing book, and it was something of a unique victory for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and an end run around the PLA. Designed primarily with the hope that there would be some halt to Taiwan arms sales. Missile pullback's a good gesture, but we need to be distinguishing threat reduction from gestures because, of course, missiles, especially solid fuels missiles, can move very easily. Now, what other roles can the U.S. play beyond being encouraging and not causing trouble or not forcing or pressing Taiwan to negotiate? Well, one category would be, I think, what's sometimes called intellectual facilitation. The U.S. government has a history of helping cross-straits dialogue by engaging in our own separate dialogues with both Beijing and Taipei to help clarify concepts, nomenclature, and generally contribute to a more trusting attitude, but not brokering, negotiating, or pushing compromises. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing and AIT in Taipei were quite active in the 2000, 2001, 2002 timeframe, actively discussing with their respective host governments what their views were and sharing their understandings because AIT and Embassy Beijing were very dynamically sharing their perspectives with each other. And that helped in some ways contribute. In the 2004-2005 timeframe, there was, I think, quite active efforts also to do the same. So there is a precedent for the U.S. playing this intellectual facilitation role. In some ways, think tanks and second-track dialogues can be most productive because they're least encumbered by things like the Six Assurances and the official moniker. This report itself, I think, is an example of how second-track dialogue can contribute to this intellectual facilitation. And I think the intellectual facilitation role could be important because, as Bonnie points out, the PRC's definition of transparency and confidence building is quite different from Taiwan's. The PLA, I think, still largely views transparency as contrary to the doctrine of dissuasion and intimidation and leverage. So there's a fundamental difference in views of what transparency means and whether it's good or bad. And the PLA or the PRC side views these CBMs as things that flow from political decisions, whereas the U.S., I think, has experience working, including with China, on CBMs that are good for conflict avoidance and accident avoidance. So in terms of intellectually preparing and contributing to more understanding of Taiwan's position in Beijing, I think the U.S. And think tanks in particular can play an important intellectual facilitation role. Also along those lines, I think many of the CBMs in the report focus on what I would consider 20th century security challenges. But in the 21st century, in the area of transformation or revolution in military affairs, there are a lot more areas of contact between nations and militaries that are a lot more complicated, including outer space and cyberspace. These are going to be extremely challenging for the U.S. to discuss with the PRC, and exponentially more challenging for Taiwan to discuss with the PRC, particularly things like cyberspace, outer space, nuclear doctrine. So to the extent the U.S. is actively engaging and attempting to begin these discussions and reduce the chance of accidental conflict in these new cyber and outer space areas, I think it can contribute and help to Taiwan. And perhaps it may be necessary for the U.S. to get some of these at some of these CBM issues because it's too hard across the straits directly. Finally, and very importantly, and two more in terms of the U.S. role, the U.S. has a very critical role in providing support and leverage for Taiwan's position. In my view, Beijing would be very satisfied with an outcome where some symbolic CBMs lead to a peace and framework agreement that is predicated on an end to U.S. arms sales to Taiwan or otherwise constraining Taiwan's defense. And if you think about the situation dynamically, not just statically, the military imbalance is growing. It is growing to Beijing's advantage. In this environment, there may be a temptation in Beijing to not push meaningful CBMs on itself, but rather to go through symbolic gestures and watch Taiwan's strategic situation get more and more, and military situation get more and more problematic, and then use a CBM process to try to lock that vulnerability in with an end to U.S. arms sales or constraints on Taiwan's readiness and interoperability and sustainability. So from Beijing's perspective, being very cynical about it, there's an advantage to very superficial CBMs that prolong a trend that is to Beijing's advantage. And I think the U.S. has a really important role to play to demonstrate to Beijing that absent substantive threat reduction from the Chinese side, this is not a trend that will continue moving in a secular way to Beijing's advantage. And for that reason, the most recent arms sales package from Washington is very helpful to this process and cross-straits generally. And in my view, F-16 CDs sometime this year will also be very important. And it's not just about arms sales. I think high-level visits, working beyond TIFA to more substantive trade understandings, cabinet-level visits, and so forth, really are all part of a critical background role the U.S. can play to ensure that Taiwan is going into this from a position of confidence and strength. I don't think there are very many historical examples of two sides, whether you argue they're sovereign or not, but of two sides entering into threat reduction negotiations where one side is confident that time is on its side and the other side's situation is degrading. So if the U.S. wants substance out of this, I think we have an important role, not just on CBMs, but generally on cross-straits, backing up Taiwan. And President Ma has been quite articulate about this point himself in his March broadcast or VTR with CSIS and other statements. Finally, the U.S. has an important role to play in what I would call an analytical support role. You know, if we move from CBMs to more substantive threat reductions, verification, monitoring, analysis will be really very important. And the capacity of Taiwan to do this will be limited. And I think the U.S. can play an important role in helping ensure and give the Taiwan side confidence that CBMs are verifiable when appropriate, irreversible, that they contribute to security. And the U.S. With analytical support and cooperation can help determine what is a gesture, what is substantive threat reduction. For all of this to work, as I said earlier, and as Bonnie points out in the report, there's going to have to be a very trusting and transparent dialogue between Taipei and Washington. I think that's the case right now. But this could become a much more fluid and dynamic situation. This is really important for three reasons. First, because the U.S. has real equities, as I mentioned earlier, and it's in Taipei's interest to make sure that U.S. equities in broader security in the Asia-Pacific region are being reinforced and not in any way intended or otherwise undermined. Secondly, it's really critical to this process. One of the key findings here is that that Taipei has a challenge maintaining domestic consensus for this process. And nothing would undermine consensus in Taiwan more than one part of the U.S. government saying they're unhappy with some aspect of cross-strait CBMs. And this happens. Believe me, it happened on my watch. Sometimes when I was in the NSC, we'd have this carefully crafted, tightly held, confidential discussion with Tokyo or Taipei, and we wouldn't tell DOD. You know, why would you? But just kidding. But we tell the Nelson Report, of course. Yeah. But every once in a while, you know, often at the request, frankly, not of the White House or the State Department or DOD, but of the other government, they'll tell the NSC or State or DOD and say, got to keep this really tight. Don't tell anyone. And then when it comes out, another part of the U.S. government says this is outrageous. When Koizumi went to Pyongyang in 2002, the PM's office asked us to keep it very tightly held. So when it came out as a big surprise, some parts of the U.S. government said this is outrageous. It's an example of why you need this kind of transparency, in part so that the U.S. government is ready when there are moves on CBMs to come out with a unified position of support and not exacerbate internal tensions within Taiwan. And finally, the U.S. can play a really critical role if it's understanding the process in building up not only leverage on Beijing through arms sales and so forth, but also building international support for CBMs, locking them in, making it hard for Beijing to reverse itself, and keeping some healthy pressure on Beijing to be more forthcoming. And I think more than any other relationship, Taipei's relationship with Washington is important for making sure the international community is backing up this process in a way that's helpful for Taiwan's security and cross-strait stability. So those are some musings beyond the report's excellent recommendations on what the U.S. might do, and I'd be interested in questions and Bonnie and Ralph's reactions.
Mike, thank you very much. I'd like to make just two very quick observations, and then I'm going to give Bonnie an opportunity to quickly respond to what she's heard so far, and then we will open it up for questions. My two observations. Number one, to say the U.S. should support cross-strait CBMs sounds like sort of a no-brainer and apple pie and motherhood, but it really is an important recommendation. I mean, the one thing that came true to me in both the mainland and in Taiwan is that there is an element, I'd say it's still a minority, but it's a strong minority that either believes that the U.S. is not in favor of improved cross-strait relations or finds it a very convenient argument to say that they believe that the U.S. is not in favor of cross-strait arguments for their own domestic political purposes. And I'm not just talking about in Taiwan. The same thing holds true on the mainland. One of the things that struck me was the number of Chinese that told us that one of the things the U.S. needed to do was be more supportive of Ma Ying-jeou. I don't think you would have heard that from the Chinese about previous Taiwan leaders, but really a concern that the U.S. Needed to be very clear in its support for cross-strait because there was elements not only in Taiwan but also on the mainland that were playing this card about the U.S. wanting to keep the two apart. So I think that's an important point. The second thing that I noticed in my own visits to Beijing and during 2009, I had either the pleasure or misfortune of having gone to China five times. And I would say as Ma's popularity went down, and it did during the course of the year, and particularly after the typhoon, China's belief that time was on its side, the thing that we heard in the beginning of the year was, well, there are certain things we'll do now and then certain things we'll do during Ma's second term. No one in Beijing talks about Ma's second term now. What they talk about is the need to sort of consolidate what's been done. So I think that there is sort of a growing concern that in Beijing that time really may not be on its side in this process, and that's where the phrase peaceful separation comes in, where they feel that if we sort of continue in the rate that we're going, us giving, Taiwan taking, that it's just going to make the the real status quo. The Chinese won't say that the status quo is that the two are separate, but in fact, that is the case, and that will become solidified. So I think that these are two things that I took away, and I don't think it contradicts what either one have said, but sort of reinforces that. But Bonnie, let me give you an opportunity to...
Thanks. I'll be brief. And thanks, Mike, for your terrific comments. I just want to pick up on respond to one and pick up on one additional one. It's obvious that the real challenge in discussing CBMs between the two sides is that they really face an asymmetrical threat. China looks at Taiwan and is concerned about the danger of Taiwan moving away from the mainland and toward independence. Taiwan faces the real military threat, not the mainland. So this is a very different problem than CBMs that are pursued, for example, between India and Pakistan, which both have similar kinds of missiles and both have nuclear weapons. So this is a real challenge, I think. And so coming up with CBMs that work for both sides, that are symmetrical, in some ways can be difficult. The transparency things, I think, are easier. But when you raise things like military exercises, I think Mike's point is exactly right, that Taiwan should not be modifying its military exercises in any way that would affect its readiness and its plans to further develop interoperability and jointness, for example. So I would agree with that. I spoke earlier about Taiwan's concern that conditions be created, favorable conditions for engaging in this dialogue about CBMs with the mainland. And one of the things that we heard stressed to us when we were in Taiwan is that there is a real need for the U.S.-Taiwan relationship to not only be strong in order for the Ma Ying-jeou government to sustain negotiations with the mainland, but also to be seen by the Taiwan populace as strong. And there are many things that take place in the U.S.-Taiwan relationship that are not very visible. Our security and military relationship is not well known, although I would argue that it is very robust. But when Ma Ying-jeou first came to power in his first 8 or 9 months in power, his near-term priority was to ease tensions with the mainland. And his main message to Washington at that time was, I will not be like my predecessor. I don't want to be a troublemaker. And really did not make demands on the United States to do things. Increasingly, there has been criticism domestically in Taiwan that Ma Ying-jeou has done so much with the mainland that he's seen as tilting toward the mainland. Now, I don't think this is necessarily the case, but it is the perception in Taiwan. And so Ma Ying-jeou's government is increasingly looking for the United States to do more, to take visible steps to strengthen the relationship so that it can be seen as strong in the eyes of the Taiwan public. And the kinds of things Mike has already referred to, not just arms sales, but also a possible cabinet secretary visit, doing more in the economic front, going beyond TIFA, for example. And so this is one thing that we heard from Taiwan officials as well as scholars that they hope will be done to create the kind of conditions so that the government in Taipei can sustain the dialogue with the mainland and eventually, if conditions are right, to engage in a conversation about military confidence building measures.
Good. Let's go ahead now and we'll open the floor up for questions and comments. I would ask you to identify yourself and try not to make your question longer than our presentations were. Chris, I saw your hand up first, so, and then this gentleman. Yeah. Right, no, right behind you.
You've got a mic right behind you.
Thanks.
But no karaoke.
No, karaoke for me would be fatal to all of us. Great presentation. Thanks so much. Obviously, the arms sale thing is the elephant in the room. While I was traipsing around the Galapagos, the Chinese seemed to be sort of escalating their rhetoric against the sale, certainly at the senior academic levels. I think the other day we saw that, you know, they're specifically threatening Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. None of my clients, alas. So a couple of questions from that. Is this what we're hearing now beyond the norm? How do we square the circle or put the round peg in that, you know, we're concerned that we not do or say anything that seems to be lowering our support? Yet, obviously, making the arms sales meets your criteria of very public demonstrations of support. Is this year's Chinese rhetoric something really serious? How do we factor how they're likely to behave? Will it hurt their cross-strait? You know, these are the kind of questions, you know, once you start pulling the sweater, you don't know where the hell to stop. And I think we'd all benefit from your sense of, you know, yeah, these sales are coming. Are the F-16s really part of it? How is that likely to affect the big picture and the bilateral U.S.-China picture? Thanks.
The Obama administration, I think, has rightfully emphasized the very great importance of the U.S.-China relationship and the many issues that we need to work on if China is not a player on climate change and responding to the financial crisis. It is really difficult to make serious progress. Of course, China is not the only country in the world, and so other countries need to join in as well. But I think that this message of China's growing importance perhaps is being interpreted in Beijing as providing China with leverage on this specific issue. And I would argue that they are probably miscalculating. I think that from what I have read in the media over the last week, we are hearing comments from Chinese, and most of them are scholars. The tough language is primarily coming from military researchers and civilian scholars, but there, of course, have also been some pointed statements opposing U.S. arms sales to Taiwan by Chinese officials. But some of these comments by scholars might be seen as trial balloons. These are messages being put out that the United States should be made to feel pain, China has put up with the Taiwan Relations Act long enough, and the U.S. should be compelled to withdraw it. And I do think that if China really expects that its importance to the U.S. is so great that it's going to influence U.S. Policy to Taiwan to the extent of ending arms sales, then I think that they have miscalculated.
Michael? The line that has come out of Beijing about arms sales recently is strong opposition to sophisticated arms sales, which presumably means F-16 CDs. So the reaction to the this is the original 2001 package. So the reaction to that that notification from Beijing is strong. I think it's perhaps stronger than – my guess would be a bit stronger than the administration expected. And some senior officials have condemned it. I think that's probably reflecting several things. One is a desire to forestall or try to preempt F-16 sales. Although Beijing can live with this package, the F-16 CDs, I think they see as, you know, as sophisticated arms sales and more problematic for them politically. Another factor, I think, is, and this this is conjecture, but I think there's an appreciation now in Beijing that President Obama's China trip did not play well in the U.S. press, and that he is under considerable pressure now to show some toughness, and they anticipate, that the Dalai Lama will meet with the president. There may be other trade things coming down the pike. So in that sense, as Bonnie suggested, trial balloon, I would say shot across the bow. Whatever your metaphor is, I think there's an expectation this is coming. And the last thing is, and here I'm on thin ground, but I would suggest that I think there's a sense in Beijing, certainly among the blogosphere and the commentariat pressing the government, that the situation has changed, that China is now the United States banker, that China has considerable influence now in the United States, and that Beijing ought to be using that leverage. That runs smack dab against another instinct, which is reflected in President Hu Jintao's statement. Was it in August, Bonnie, to the diplomatic, to the visiting ambassadors in July, that the U.S.-China relationship is the most important bilateral relationship for Beijing, and keeping that stable is critical for Chinese diplomacy. So there's some internal tension here, I think. But at the end of the day, I think Bonnie's right. The administration would be making a huge mistake to suggest that it is going to now back down on things like arms sales or other other issues because of the rhetoric coming out of Beijing. And the key challenge will be to not back down while managing a stable relationship. So I'm sorry for going on so long. When I was – during the campaign, I worked for McCain, and Jeff Bader and I used to comment offline that this was the first presidential election in some time where China was not a major issue, where the two candidates weren't beating each up. If you think about Ford to Carter and Carter to Reagan and then Bill Clinton with the butchers of Beijing and so on and so forth, and the strategic competitor comment of Condi Rice in 2000. This was the first presidential cycle where both sides had a fairly, looking at Richard Bush, you know, fairly steady, fairly bipartisan approach, and which gave the administration in some ways an unprecedented amount of leeway politically to start crafting its China policy in the first year. The irony may now be that in the second and third years, they're being forced into the politics of China that they were able to avoid the first year.
I would agree with both. The one question that I don't think we covered, Chris, was how does this impact cross-strait? And my guess would be not very much. It's one of the sort of unique characteristics that the Chinese take their displeasure out on the seller as opposed to the buyer. And that seems to be Taiwanese seem to be well aware of that and therefore are much less hesitant about worrying about the consequences. The attitude that I seem to hear in Taiwan was, well, this is one you Americans have to suck up for us. And they don't seem to be too worried about a Chinese response. But I'm going to try to sort of go to opposite sides of the room to cover cross-strait. So, Nancy, let me ask you next.
Nancy Bernkoff-Tucker, Georgetown University. This is directly to Mike. U.S.-Japan relations are not as good as they might be, and the discussion has been largely on issues of American military in Japan, perhaps that the new government wants to improve relations with China a lot, and that makes us uncomfortable. How does cross-strait figure into this and the possibility of real CBMs? Is this going to worry the Japanese, scare them? What kind of reaction are they likely to have?
Could everyone hear the question?
Yeah. The question was, to paraphrase, now that U.S.-Japan relations are a little wobbly, I forget the word you use, but it difficult, is the prospect of cross-strait CBM is going to worry the Japanese side. It's a hard question to answer because, in any democracy you have a variety of views, and Japan's democracy and coalition government now is particularly untidy, and it's particularly difficult to ascribe one view on this. You have Ichiro Ozawa, the Secretary General of the party, who took a delegation of over 600 political followers to Beijing. I'm told Hu Jintao shook every person's hand in the delegation, which was means something. I don't know what. That's a lot of it's a lot of Purell. In contrast, you have people like Seiji Maihara, or Aki Nagashima, the Vice Defense Minister, who are pretty strong on the U.S.-Japan alliance and pretty hardline, frankly, on China. So within the DPJ, it's hard to say what the common view is. Operationally, the relationship between the U.S. and Japanese bureaucracies and the U.S. and Japanese military is excellent. And my own sense is most of the DPJ also has a pretty strong commitment to the alliance, but they're having difficulty sorting out how they're going to handle some specific issues. The most problematic is Futenma, this Marine Corps Air Station in Okinawa, and in some ways that's the biggest problem for Taiwan, because if this some people say, you know, it's just one air base. Why are we letting the whole U.S.-Japan alliance get all tied up around this? And I think in Hawaii today, Hillary Clinton is going to talk about a broader vision for the alliance so that we're not completely consumed with Futenma. But it's pretty darn important, because if Prime Minister Hatoyama, by putting this decision off on implementing Futenma, causes it to fall apart, then the rest of the package, which involves moving Marines to Guam and realigning bases, is going to freeze because the U.S. Congress will not pay for it. The new facility in Futenma that's in dispute is a condition for the overall move, which will mean that the U.S. presence in Okinawa will essentially freeze in its Cold War structure, which will be very frustrating for the Okinawans, for Tokyo, and for the Marines and everybody involved. And that starts to raise questions about how sustainable that presence is and how much support there is in Japan for the U.S. forward presence in Okinawa, which is strategically important across the region, but especially on the Taiwan Straits. So if I were in Taipei, I'd be watching this very, very nervously. Even if the DPJ has the right intentions, the signals it sends are problematic. And, you know, dissuading China, the PRC, from thinking it can use force to resolve the Taiwan problem is, you know, a particular mission for the U.S. because of the Taiwan Relations Act and so forth. But the U.S.-Japan alliance plays a critical role in that. And the strengthening of the revision of defense guidelines, the strengthening of U.S.-Japan interoperability over the last decade or so, I think has been a really important factor in Chinese thinking about how it approaches the Taiwan problem and the utility of force. And so if, to the extent that's wobbly, it doesn't help. But that said, I think Takaoka will talk to his friends in Tokyo, and hopefully we will we'll get through this. But the next few months will be uncertain.
Good. I wouldn't be the shameless self-promoter I am if I didn't mention to you that on Friday at the Willard Hotel from 10 to noon, there will be a public forum on Japanese domestic politics hosted by the Pacific Forum. And from 2 to 5 on Friday, again at the Willard, there will be a public forum on the U.S.-Japan alliance, where we have been and where we are going, featuring Bill Perry and Rich Armitage and a couple of others. It's open to the public. If you need more information on it, give me an email address, and I'm happy to send you info. Now, I saw a gentleman. Yes, right here.
Hi, thank you. David Ahn from the State Department. Question, following up on Mr. Michael Green's comments on superficial versus kind of substantive or effective CBMs, I'm wondering, the impression would be that CBMs should be mutually binding. So how would constraints imposed on Taiwan not also bind China? Could you kind of go more into the nuances? Or how would an increase in Taiwan's disadvantage, how would that lead to an increase in Taiwan's disadvantage rather than lower tensions on both sides?
That's fair. That's the usual pattern. Well, as Bonnie pointed out, see, she can't correct me if I quote her. As Bonnie pointed out, this is a unique dynamic because Taiwan is in the far more vulnerable position and has limited, if not zero, capacity to attack the mainland. It's overwhelmingly a threat aimed in one direction. So any binding CBM that freezes or constrains Taiwan's ability to continue improving and making up for gaps in readiness and capability and interoperability is not threat reduction, even if there's a degree of mutuality to it. And frankly, even I would think that mutual steps at threat reduction will be pretty tough because of there's also an imbalance in transparency. It's not to say they shouldn't be on the agenda for the longer term and address, but those are and I, by the way, I'm out of the box a bit. I'm not suggesting in any way the U.S. would in the future blanket oppose these things, but it would be a concern or something that would be watched to make sure it didn't lock in not only the imbalance, but lock it in a way where it continues to accrue to China's military benefit. Correct.
Well, first I should say CBMs are unlike, as you know, arms control treaties. I mean, they're not legally binding. They're sort of politically binding. The upside of that is that they're sort of easier to enter into. The downside is that then they're easier to back out of. So there has to be political will on both sides to do that. So binding is not quite a word that I would apply to CBMs, at least certainly not in the legal sense. But I think that the really important thing for the from the mainland and Taiwan to do are to continue to engage in what I would call a process of reciprocal unilateral CBM steps, so that each side can take some measures to signal political goodwill to the other side. Now, in a preliminary stage, those steps are likely to have more political meaning or significance or symbolism than real military significance. And Mike talked earlier about a few missiles or hundreds of them could be pulled back but could be rolled forward in the event that the mainland wanted to do so. And that's an important point, but it would nevertheless be politically symbolic and a useful gesture to begin that process of pulling them back. Eventually, the hope is that they would be dismantled and destroyed. And more recently, President Ma has pointed out that, of course, the threat to Taiwan goes beyond the missiles. We spend a lot of time just talking about the missiles, but it's far broader than that. And he has now said that publicly. And so I think that steps, particularly since the threat is asymmetrical, that both sides need to think about what they can do unilaterally to build some trust with the other side. And there may be those steps may, in many cases, be asymmetrical. Through negotiations, there might be different kinds of CBMs that could be agreed upon, but there's a lot that can be done in the near term and even in the longer term unilaterally.
John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. It's kind of interesting that it is the U.S.-Taiwan relations that probably need some urgent CBMs that we are here to discuss cross-strait CBMs. But anyways, it's I have a question with regards to a point already discussed by Bonnie and Mike to some extent, but I'd like to explore a little bit further. Usually, CBMs work best between rivals or adversaries of equal strength. What would be the incentive for the PRA to really agree to embark on this? You know, beyond superficial measures like accident preventing, rescue missions, you know, the real CBMs, what is the incentive for the PRA to do this, particularly when arms sales is not going to come into play? Thank you.
Well, I think that's an important question, but I want to take it up to a higher level and ask what's the incentive for the mainland more broadly. I mean, the PLA itself, more narrowly minded, may see that there is little incentive in cutting back the deployments that they have made, but the PLA doesn't make final decisions on the mainland. And so I think it's really important to ask more broadly, why should China engage in this process? And I would argue that if China has the goal of improving relations with Taiwan, settling differences with Taiwan, and preventing Taiwan from moving in a direction toward independence that it doesn't like, that needs to take very significant steps to really win over the hearts and minds of the people. I think that the shift in China's policy away from a policy of pushing for near-term reunification and emphasizing more a process, the process of peaceful development, that CBMs fits in very well with that new policy as stated by Hu Jintao, to develop a peaceful development across the straits and to convince the people on Taiwan that China has goodwill for them, not ill will. There's a hell of a lot that China needs to do in order to achieve that goal. And as long as the people, as President Ma has said, as long as the people of Taiwan face this huge military opposite them, how are they to be convinced that the mainland really does have goodwill? So I think there's a lot of incentive there at the top. But for the PLA, I think it's understandable they would be more narrow-minded.
I completely agree with that. And one of the things we, I think, in the U.S. discovered with the EP3 incident, with the more recent incidents in the South China Sea, is that crisis management is difficult with Beijing because civilian control of the military is so opaque, if not weak. Yes, Hu Jintao chairs the Central Military Commission, but up and down the bureaucracy, you don't have the kind of connections that you have in our governments between the civilian bureaucracy and the military, and you don't have the kind of transparency. So in some ways, from my perspective, when you pursue transparency and CBMs with China, whether it's Taiwan or the U.S., part of it is testing the ability of the civilian officials to manage the PLA, or the extent to which there is a crisis management capability or connection within China. It's in some ways CBMs, in other words, are a little bit of a test and an exploration of the nature of the other side's decision making, transparency, and civil military relations. And if it goes well, then that reinforces confidence. If it goes badly, it makes you wonder about it.
Yeah. Mike Fonte, I'm the DPP liaison here in Washington. Thanks again for a great presentation. I just wondered, Bonnie, if you could explore a little bit for us the question of transparency of the Ma administration on a variety of issues has been a critique of the DPP, certainly. It covers a range of issues, and obviously the consensus building that's necessary for serious CBMs is an issue here that you've already spoken about. So I wonder if you'd explore for us a bit of what kind of input, if any, you got in your conversations from people who are considered, quotes, green, that is, lean towards the DPP side of the equation, and whether there's any real incentive on the Chinese side to include a broader range of people in the discussions about CBMs.
Well, we certainly did talk to members of the DPP, and I should point out, and do point out in the report, that the DPP, when it was in power, was a strong proponent of confidence-building measures with the mainland. In fact, if you go back and look at defense white papers from Taiwan from 2002 and 2004, there's a far lengthier and more detailed section on military CBMs than there is in the current one that has been released under Ma Ying-jeou's government in 2009. There were specific proposals such as establishing like a no-fly zone in the strait where fighters on both sides would remain a certain distance from that center line, and the mainland did not respond positively to that. But certainly the DPP has strongly advocated CBMs and would want to be consulted. I think the Taiwan people would want to have an input on issues relating to cross-strait relations. I think that from the Chinese perspective, there has long been recognition that excluding the opposition, not having any kind of dialogue with the opposition is really not in Beijing's interest. I would say they have not done enough to engage DPP members, but they have certainly invited individuals not as representing their party in individual capacities, some of which, in fact, I recall last year there was a conference on the mainland and two DPP members went and were subsequently expelled from the party. So the DPP obviously has to see that there is a value in talking to China as well. It's a two-way street.
Gentleman in the red shirt.
Hi, Matt Fitzsimmons, DOD. My question is, if China may desire to lock in any agreements made with Ma prior to 2012 because of his political weakness, but if a DPP resurgence occurs, wouldn't that invalidate any agreements that Ma may agree to and that were made without a domestic consensus in Taiwan? And does China realize that?
I think clearly, potentially, anything that is agreed upon could be reversed. But sometimes once governments agree on something and they begin to see some value in what they are doing, for example, if there were a hotline established, would it necessarily – perhaps it might fall into disuse, but it would still be functional, just as CEF and ARATS continue, for example, to exist, even though they were not performing the same kind of functions that they are performing under the Ma government. The hope, of course, in the mainland side is that the things that they would establish survive a KMT regime. I think they're perfectly aware of the fact that there are no guarantees, and some kinds of arrangements, I think, would be more likely to survive than others. There are some things that occurred during the DPP administration that also haven't been reversed. Disbandment, what was the word that was used, of the
deactivation.
The unfreezing. Right.
Information.
Yeah. Right. Of the What was it called?
National Unification.
Thank you, National Unification Council. I appreciate that. Obviously, it was very difficult. Ma Ying-jeou chose not to reverse that, even though that was something that he would like to have seen remain in place. And so sometimes it's difficult for new governments to reverse what have been done by agreed upon by previous governments.
Of a DPP to power. Especially now, viewing the mass popularity is going down. My question is, in case DPP does return to power in 2012, which some observers believe that it's not something impossible, what will happen? How about the WHA? And how about the ECFA to be signed? And how about the other agreement already signed?
Your question is, in the event that Ma Ying-jeou has another 4 years, what will happen?
If the DPP comes
to power? Up to the DPP, if it were to come back to power, to decide whether or not it would continue to honor, if there is an economic framework agreement, and I would say the same that I said to the previous questioner, if there is some value in that economic cooperation agreement, I think it would be very difficult once you have removed tariffs on specific items to completely reverse that. You might not go further. But I think that there are people in the DPP today who are saying publicly that an ECFA is right for Taiwan. For example, I think Xu Xinliang the other day said publicly that the DPP should not oppose a cross-strait economic framework agreement. There have been others, like, for example, former Vice President Annette Liu, who have said that there should not be a referendum against the ECFA because that could be the odds are that it would not pass. So I think there's a lot of different views within the DPP, and it remains to be seen if they came back to power what their policy would be on this specific issue.
Hi, Colonel Huang from Army War College. It's good that I'm here as a scholar, so I can speak freely for the first time. Usually, I don't. It was great discussion and here, but I want to phrase in the Chinese phrase that 内行人看门道，外行人看热闹. That means if you're insider, that you look into the niche point, but if you're outsider, you only look for and watch for the cheerfulness. I would describe, as most of the people right now describe, this relationship has been improved, you know, unprecedentedly well in ever. But I would caution, I would describe in the phrase, this is a beautiful wave that has many, many sharp corries underneath the water. Let's look in the back of the history. It has gone back. This MCBM or CBM, you know, it's one way or two, you know, one way or the other. Let's don't forget about MCBMs. Serve is not a final purpose. It's one of the tool. The final purpose is driven by the political trust. And I also think you all here implies there are so many lack, so many will agree with me, there's basically lack of political trust. And that's the real question. Let's go back to the history of constitution on both sides. There is a real problem here. You cannot get MCBM or CBN going unless there's one problem, which is, I think we're on well on the track, which is 1992 consensus, that's one China. As far as you want to interpret which China, let's leave that in ambiguous because for the good of all sides. Yes. So the question is, until that China and Taiwan recognize the sovereignty, which is recognized by both sides are the same, the sovereignty should be, and the territory should be shared by both sides. Unless that is recognized in some kind of form, there is no room for MCBMs. There is no room for other things. Let's look at the real deep. That's my question would be, how do you create that room as a facilitator that most of the people here, and I think in Richard Bush four or five years ago, mentioned in his book, Untie the Knots, he mentioned a lot of points in there. How do we be that facilitator here in the U.S. for creating that environment? I think we should.
I would agree with you that the absence of political trust is the problem. The two sides obviously do not agree fundamentally on the issue of sovereignty. But I would disagree that there must be an agreement to share sovereignty or have some solution on the settling the differences over sovereignty before CBMs can be agreed upon. The reason why we have had progress in the cross-strait relationship, one of the reasons, is because sovereignty has been shelved for the time being. Both sides are crystal clear about their respective positions, and they recognize that it is not in their interest to try and solve the sovereignty issue in the near term. So I think that it's important to use the opportunities that exist now to build a greater political trust, as you say, and to postpone the discussion of sovereignty down the road. And I would add that although many people in this country and other places are concerned that relations between Taiwan and the mainland will get too close, I myself think that we have seen a significant amount of progress in the two sides of the Straits relationship. We probably will see more. But the dangers of them hitting insurmountable obstacles and vectoring in opposite directions, having a reemergence of tensions, irrespective of whether the DPP comes back to power, by the way, I think that that is perhaps more likely than a real settlement of differences that results in ultimate unification. So I worry more personally about setbacks in this process than I do about real integration and unification between the two sides.
Hi, Mike Losny from MIT and NDU. I have a question about a stronger U.S.-Taiwan relationship and how it ties into CBMs. Both in Bonnie's recommendations, and it sounds like Mike agrees, that this is almost a requirement to get to CBMs and to get the Taiwanese to be able to go along domestically is to have a stronger U.S.-Taiwan relationship. And, you know, this goes back 20-plus years to the Six Assurances and the idea of needing Taiwan to feel strong enough so that when they interact with the mainland and negotiate with the mainland, they don't feel like they're going to be coerced. And this kind of sounds like a newer version of that argument. When we then bring the way the PRC views this back into play, many of the same things that you would want the U.S. to do to strengthen the U.S.-Taiwan relationship are the exact same things that the PRC would view as interfering in this and sending signals to separatist forces and all that. Is there any evolution on the mainland side of seeing the link that we like to push between stronger U.S.-Taiwan relations as being a requirement to get to CBMs? I mean, Bonnie talked about a recognition that Mangzhou's weak, that there's a lack of domestic consensus. Is there any either change in the PRC or anything that the U.S. can do to help sell the PRC on that link itself of saying that we need to have stronger U.S.-Taiwan relations to get to CBMs?
I think the short answer first is that there is little appreciation on the mainland side, except when you get maybe one person in a room and nobody else is listening. There are individuals who will acknowledge that if Taiwan feels insecure and vulnerable, that it is not likely to continue this policy of moderation towards the mainland and to move forward and to negotiate on some of these sensitive issues. So I would say the recognition exists in the minds of some individuals. Whether it has percolated up to the top leaders, I don't know. But on the official level in Beijing, there is no acceptance of the notion that a strong U.S.-Taiwan relationship is helpful. And I would argue that at this particular juncture in time, especially, that a strong U.S.-Taiwan relationship is in Beijing's interest, and that includes arms sales. If Ma Ying-jeou is seen as tilting toward China, and as a result the people vote him out of office, that will not make China happy. They would certainly like to keep him in power and keep the KMT in power. And if Ma feels so insecure and so pressured by the mainland and vulnerable to coercion by the mainland, then he will slow down not move beyond the economic issues that have been the focus of negotiations so far. So I would say that a strong U.S.-Taiwan relationship at this particular juncture in time is helpful for Beijing, and I would encourage China to recognize that and limit its opposition to arms sales, which I understand why they are opposed, but to limit it to rhetoric and responses that do not have a prolonged, extensive negative impact on the U.S.-China relationship.
I only briefly add that you can get CBMs with a weak Taiwan. They're just not the CBMs you want. So, and as the Colonel pointed out, the purpose is not to have CBMs, it's to reduce the risk of conflict, to build confidence, reduce the threat if you can. The other thing I would say is that, you know, the U.S. support for Taiwan in terms of cabinet visits, arms sales, and so forth goes beyond this question of cross-straits dynamics and really gets to the heart of the question of what the rise of Chinese power means. If the rise of Chinese power means that we no longer that we change policies on basic relationships like the TRA with Taiwan, then that has implications for the credibility of our alliance with Japan, with Australia, with Korea, our relationship with India, across the whole Asia-Pacific region. So it's not just a matter of helping facilitate cross-straits CBMs and confidence. It's also a question about a much more fundamental question about the nature of how the U.S. and the region integrates China in a positive way.
I appreciate it, Ralph. It's Peter Spiegel with The Wall Street Journal. I want to go back to Chris's opening question about arms sales. And frankly, you may have just answered the question, so it may be moot. But the dynamic that you described in your opening comments about Beijing concerned that all these gains they've made with the KMT since they came to government may be lost because of diminished political support within Taiwan for the current government, that would seem to argue that the reaction towards the imminent arms sales would somehow be different, that they are conscious that Ma is losing support and therefore would modulate the reaction to arms sales. It sounds like what you're saying is that in your discussions with the PRC side, there is no awareness, although there's awareness that the KMT is in danger politically, there's no awareness that the rhetoric on the arms sales is in any way affecting that. Can you address what you heard from the PRC in terms of the rhetoric and how it could affect KMT popularity domestically?
For those on the mainland who follow this, they do so very closely. They quote polling numbers. They note that Ma Ying-jeou's support has been well below 30%. We were there just in the aftermath of the typhoon, the government was being very, very harshly attacked. And that was cited as a cause for urgency to begin to address more sensitive political and military issues. So there's certainly awareness. But I think on the mainland, we have to remember that domestic politics trumps everything. And there is a perception in the mainland, and I don't have a way of proving this. Perhaps they do polls internally that they don't share with the outside, but there certainly is a claim that the leadership is under great pressure from the domestic population to protect China's sovereignty, territorial integrity, that Taiwan, along with Tibet and Xinjiang, are China's core national interests. And so they're with this
perception that there is criticism from the domestic population, there is a sense in the leadership that they have to be tough. And if you combine this with what I said earlier, their assessment that their position in the world has grown and the United States is valuing the U.S.-China relationship more and that we're on more equal footing because they own so much of our treasury bonds, that this then provides, they believe, greater leverage over the United States on this issue. And this is where I would point back to what I said earlier that I do think is a miscalculation, that ultimately the United States has its interest as well. And it's not just interests in U.S. relations with Taiwan, as important as those are, but it's also our credibility throughout the entire region and more globally and the commitments that we make to our allies. And I would say that when in 1996, when the Clinton administration dispatched two aircraft carriers to the region, it was not just to respond to the threat that China's missiles faced as they were being fired toward the island, but also the way the administration thought about how it would be perceived by other countries in the region and our broader reputation in the region.
I think I just add a brief code. I think that's exactly right. And this is what President Obama might call a teachable moment. In some ways, it's all the more important now. And I think my sense is this is where the White House is, judging from their actions this month. It's all the more important now to demonstrate that the financial crisis has not changed the fundamentals, that the president will see the Dalai Lama, that arms sales will move forward. And even if that causes a rough patch in U.S.-China relations, my sense is the administration is prepared and strategically and politically sees it as necessary to go down that road. And Secretary Clinton, in her comments to the Post, tried to put some context around it and emphasize the positive, but I didn't detect anything in what she said that would suggest that there won't be a pretty firm moving forward on some of these issues, even if Beijing doesn't like it over the next few months.
Yeah, I would say in some respects, as we all know, the Chinese have painted themselves in a corner. If we say we're going to sell bow and arrow to Taiwan, they have the same, harsh reaction, and it's the end of the world. So, but when you talk to Chinese privately, my sense is that they do make a distinction between the 2001 package and the F-16 C's and D's. That is the real difference in China. And they can probably huff and puff and not do much more on the 2001 package, but it would be very hard-pressed to ignore F-16 C's and D's. So I think there is sort of a distinguishing point there. I think Bonnie's point is also very true. I have run a number of different U.S.-China conferences, and at one of them, my closing remark to our Chinese colleagues was, beware of premature arrogance. The Chinese, I think, have become extremely overconfident will probably do a little bit of miscalculating. And it's only natural that they're going to test to see just how far they can push. And I think they'll get the pushback, and that will be a useful lesson as we go forward. Please join me in thanking both Bonnie and Mike and our questioners.